You will now hear Christine Conley on the new discourse and epistemological consequences of history.
Okay, I just want to check the, it's very important that the slides be in the right spot here. Are the slides right, Dalton?
Oh, okay.
Okay, I don't want to. Okay, good. I just want to check that. Good. No. Okay. Yeah. No, it's okay. Leave it. That's fine. Good. Okay. The other way. Good. Okay, can you hear me? That's fine. No. Closer. Okay, is that better? All right. The title of my paper is Trauma, History, and the Narrativization of Space. It is to Freud that we owe our understanding of trauma as the very limit point of perception and of representation. His observations of psychic suffering in war veterans or in those who survive disastrous train or car collisions seemingly unscathed form the basis of our contemporary understanding of trauma as a sudden and catastrophic experience so overwhelming that it fails to register consciously at the time of occurrence. Rather, there is a period of latency, a delay between the initial shock and the appearance of neuroses in the form of repetitious nightmares, hallucinations, hysteria. This temporal delay determines the experience of trauma as return, as reenactment, and as repetition, unperceived and hence unrepresentable. Trauma functions at the limit of the symbolic as its very impossibility, what Lacan links in his rereading of Freud to the function of the real as missed encounter. In her book Unclaimed Experience, Trauma, Narrative, and History, Kathy Karros evokes this topology of trauma to address the concern raised in recent literary criticism that, and I quote her, the epistemological problems raised by post-structuralist criticism necessarily lead to political and ethical paralysis. The gist of this argument is that if history can no longer be understood as straightforwardly referential, we cannot make political or ethical judgments about other cultures because we do not have direct access to their histories, or for that matter, to our own. To counter this potential abandonment of the ethical and political terrain, Karros proposes that the perplexing nature of trauma's etiology, where the relation of experience to reference is also not straightforward, offers the possibility for a rethinking of reference that does not eliminate history, but permits, quote, history to arise where immediate understanding may not. Karros turns to Freud's intricate weaving of the story of the Jews and the story of the Christians in Moses and monotheism in an effort to, quote, rethink the possibility of history as well as our ethical and political relation to it. Freud wrote Moses and monotheism between 1934 and 1938 during his final years in Vienna before the Nazi invasion, or Anschluss, precipitated his departure for England. He had caused then to consider not only the immediate threat of National Socialism in Germany, but also the history of repeated confrontation with anti-Semitism that had shaped Jewish culture. Freud's account of the historical antagonism between Christianity and Judaism is a narrative of repetition and return, where the trauma of early Jewish history is inscribed within the traumatic narrative of Christ's passion. Now, what interests me here is not to rehearse the substance of Freud's analysis, but what Karros perceives as his central insight about history, quote, that history, like trauma, is never simply one's own, that history is precisely the way we are implicated in each other's traumas. Karros' reading of Freud is certainly resonant with the escalating tensions of current conflicts. My concern in this paper is its resonance with visual art installations, where trauma is the impetus for a narrativizing of the space of the museum gallery in ways that compel us to bear witness to the traumas of others. First, I wish to note that this paper marks another kind of return to 1999, when Judith Bastai edited an issue of the journal Collapse, which included my essay on Charlotte Zolomon's Life or Theater, where I focused upon these issues of trauma and history. I later had the pleasure of working with Judith once the exhibition of Life or Theater came to the AGO. As a Jew in exile from Germany in 1940, Zolomon's history of a hidden family of a hidden family history of suicides and her knowledge of being the sole survivor precipitated a story in painted images and texts which, in its repetitious returns and reenactments, can only be accessed as trauma. On the left is the title page to her painted opera, and on the right the scene, the pivotal scene, where in exile in France with her grandparents, her grandmother has attempted suicide and failed, and her grandfather then reveals the history of suicides of her maternal line, including the death of her mother. Okay. My essay argued that Zolomon's narrative of personal catastrophe gives figuration to a larger historical reality, the crisis at the heart of German-Jewish identity under the Nazi regime, and corresponds to the model of history proposed by Walter Benjamin, which he famously emblematized in the figure of the Angel of History. And this is just an instance here of the kind of repetition that takes place. On the left, the actual suicide of the grandmother to which she bears witness, and then her construction of her mother's suicide through the same method of jumping through the window, which of course she did not witness. Benjamin's perception of history as the wreckage at the feet of the angel caught in terror between the desire to flee and the desire to rescue the past from oblivion is a vision of history as catastrophe that is irreconcilable with the positivistic understanding of history as a continuum. In its non-synchronicity, it corresponds more closely to Freud's model of memory in the mystic writing pad, the children's toy that allows for the continual erasure of the writing surface through its separation from the wax surface below, where the script persists in the form of permanent traces. Zolomon introduced a similar structure in Life or Theater through the use of transparent overlays, where she wrote the lyrics that identify the music for each scene of her musical play, and directions or commentary that take the form of a voiceover, such as we find in film, producing a work of unprecedented hybridity in the sense that it suggests simultaneous incarnations as theater, opera, film, and book. On the right is an example of the overlay over the painted image where she would write in the persona another kind of voice, a commentary on the events portrayed. Possibly our first instance of a female voiceover in film, if only in the form of a script. However, the fragility of these overlays that severely limits their exhibition poses problems for apprehending these multiple dimensions in gallery installations. The acoustic, theatrical, and cinematic aspects can only be accessed through our imaginative engagement with the work as a text, notwithstanding the supplementing of audio guides and text panels. Life or Theater may be seen then as a script of sorts for the kind of installation art that emerged only decades later. Arnold Dreiblatt's The Recollection Mechanism, which you see on the left, and Mary Kelly's Mea Culpa on the right, both date from 1999. Like Zalman, Dreblad, and Kelly are interested in visual models for psychic reality, and in these works at least, present stories of personal loss, exile, and catastrophe that in their very fragmentation and failure to provide the big picture, allow another kind of history to arise. Unlike life or theater, however, the visual narrative matrix of these installations does not involve images, but rather texts, and further, realizes a certain spatial coherence through a narrativization of space that solicits our entry and movement as embodied subjects. The narrativization of space is a term that Mary Kelly has used in reference to her own work and to artists such as Shirin Neshat and William Kentridge. It is a term from film theory derived from Stephen Heath's 1976 essay, Narrative Space, whereby the film camera is synchronized with the movement in the frame to produce a coherent and unified space in relation to a stationary spectator. Suture, the operation that establishes the film viewer's identification with the screen image, is another term linked to this regulation of scene and movement in the construction of the viewing subject. But in these works, the narrativization of space does not reproduce the normative values of cinematic spectacle, but rather creates a tension between the phenomenological body that Merleau-Ponty describes as that body at one with the flesh of the world, and the radical cut of the symbolic circuit that is trauma. Arnold Dreblad is a New York-born artist and composer who has traveled and lived in Europe since 1983 and is presently based in the former East Berlin. He is perhaps better known in North America as a musician and founder of the Orchestra of Excited Strings in New York. During the mid-1970s, he worked with Lamonti Young. He was involved in the experimental film and video scene, collaborated with the Vasalkas, and showed his work at the Anthology Film Archives. But in 1978, he abandoned video for experimental music and composition. In 1985, a chance encounter in a used bookstore in Istanbul triggered an investigation of the archive as memory that has driven his subsequent production of a book, a hypertext opera, interactive media installations and performances, and a website. Before being shown at the Jewish Museum in New York in 2001, the recollection mechanism was part of a larger installation entitled From the Archives at the Hamburger Bahnhof Museum of Contemporary Art in Berlin. And Dreblad has since exhibited a work called The Wunderblock, inspired by Freud's essay on the mystic writing pad. The incipit for Dreblad's obsession with the architecture of memory is the book that he happened across in Istanbul, a copy of Who's Who in Central and East Europe, published in 1933, just as Hitler embarked on his own rewriting of history. The volume was the first and last biographical dictionary for this entire European region until 1989. As Dreblad notes, both books were almost immediately obsolete as the worlds they documented disappeared. This Who's Who contains over 10,000 biographies of important scientists, educators, politicians, industrialists, artists, and so on. They lived in countries such as Austria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Lithuania, Yugoslavia. This Who's Who is unusual in that the biographical entries were not written by the British editors, but by the subjects themselves. So they include personal information that introduces a heterogeneity to the customary flattening out of experience in bureaucratic records, and a degree of poignancy to the fact that the fate of these individuals after 1933 remains unknown. One can only imagine why this book sparked such an epiphany for Dreblad, a Jew from New York whose grandparents emigrated from Poland, who had been traveling throughout Europe, East and West, and had recently discovered a forgotten branch of his family in the Soviet Union. But that is all we can only imagine, because this project is not autobiographical. On the contrary, it points to both the artist's and our own fascination with biographical detail, but ultimately the insufficiency of such dictionaries to convey the fullness of a life. In the recollection mechanism, the recollection mechanism is one of the many transformations of this original text, which Dreybach has treated as canonical. That is, as a text like the Bible that is complete and cannot be added to. He is engaged in a constant rewriting of the text that amounts to a deconstruction of biography as a form of knowledge. He chose 765 entries, a representative sample of nationalities, minority groups, religions, and occupations, and created a hypertext of cross-reference categories that provides a kind of structural analysis of the biographical form. These fragments of information were then stored as a database. What you see when you enter this dark space is a cylindrical scroll made from wire mesh and suspended in the center of the room. It functions as a three-dimensional screen for the projection of layers of text from two computers, which are constantly searching the database for keywords, randomly selected from a list composed by the artist, and projecting streams of entries that correspond to that word. There are two projections, one up on the wall and one that sweeps the floor. The text moves from left to right, so one is kept very busy attempting to read these unsynchronized text fields. There is also an audio component. Each of the keywords is spoken by a male or female voice and simultaneously highlighted on the screen. The insufficiency of these fragments as knowledge is given. The insufficiency of these fragments as knowledge is given material form through the disappearance of the moving text from view. The structure of the suspended form is only perceived as a scroll when you walk to the side of the projection path, as you see on the right. It is a view seen obliquely as you enter or leave the room from exits on either side, much like the skull in Holbein's painting The Ambassadors, which is most frequently cited to illustrate anamorphosis, the appearance of the real in the sudden decipherability of the form. From this angle, where Dreyblatt has installed seating, the movement of text projection coalesces into the vision of a turning scroll, into which the text disappears in a continual effacement that inscribes a haunting absence. The model of memory that Dreybach invokes in this spectral vision is the Torah, the book of the written law that cannot be altered, while his process of extraction, interpretation, and cross-referencing in the construction of the hypertext is based upon the endless oral commentary of Talmud inquiry. The difference between the written and the oral law is then repeated in the play of text and voice. Judaism, of course, privileges the ear over sight, or as Levinas would have it, the ethical over the ontological. So there is an ethical imperative to this listening, not so unlike Freud, to the audible traces of lives lost or transformed by the forces of war. We bear witness to the evidence of individual forgotten lives committed to a collective identity and fate after 1933. The tension between recovery and erasure is here in the oblique view, on the left, that speaks the language of anamorphosis, a language that Rosalind Krauss has described as the mutual eclipse of the pictorial and the sculptural as separate modalities of experience, evident here in the fading in and out of decipherability of the Torah scroll. Krauss was describing the anamorphic quality of Eva Hesse's contingent when she wrote, "The meaning of death is understood literally as the condition of the world's disappearing from view." But I am showing you Psalms 2, installed and with a color detail, as it is my lead into Mary Kelly's Mea Culpa. Its terms of spectatorship, shifting between a sculpture that solicits our movement and a pictorial catching the light as it flickers across the gallery, frame after frame, like a film. Now, as some of you may not have heard Mary Kelly's presentation on Thursday evening, I will address briefly the making of Mea Culpa, which consists of four long horizontal panels hung at eye level. Behind the plexiglass are a series of units made of compacted lint, lint that has accumulated in the filter of the artist's clothes dryer through the process of washing and drying 4,000 pounds of laundry. so that each unit takes on the characteristic shape of the filter screen. Two of the long panels are 16 feet long, the other two are 20, and they are 17 inches high. Across the banner-like procession of these units are texts based upon media accounts of war-related atrocities, accounts that span three decades and four countries, Cambodia, Lebanon, Bosnia, and South Africa. I'm going to just read two of these for you. Phnom Penh, 1975. She watched soldiers in a rice paddy beat her daughter with the butts of their rifles until she was dead. Then she had headaches and trouble with her eyes. To distract herself, she worked at the bridge of her nose with a knife. When the pain subsided, she could no longer see. These texts have not been added to the accumulated lint, but are integral to each unit's very formation. Kelly produced the first overlay on the grid of the filter screen with loads of black laundry. The detail here. Black being, of course, the color of choice for artists, but at the same time, the color of mourning. She then applied a stencil of letters before continuing with loads of white laundry to achieve the desired gradations in tone. The black letters are formed then through a process akin to intaglio, forming narratives of extreme violation and anguish through the mechanical revolutions of a commonplace and somewhat antiquated household appliance. This strange encounter, reminiscent of surrealist poetry, serves to blur the boundaries between the reassuring routines of the domestic realm and the unpredictable events in the outer world. For, of course, it is most frequently within our homes that we encounter the surfeit of media news with its accounts of war, disaster, torture, genocide. Beirut, 1982. No running water. She washed dishes near the pump and listened. Rockai cluster bombs dispensed their submunitions, 247 8-inch dart grenades, 262.4 pounds of high density explosives, 200,000 shrapnel fragments armed with an aluminum pan, four unmatched plates, two glasses, three spoons. And a kitchen knife. She held her child and waited. This is the full view now of the piece. By the very nature of Kelly's process, each of the 72 units is randomly unique, though the use of cotton rather than synthetic fabrics results in an overall consistency in the surface texture, a fine even residue like powdered ashes. While there is no recognizable imagery as such, the lint surface is rich in its verging on figuration, suggesting the gray matter that incorporates the everyday filtering through of traumatic events. Kelly's narratives do not replicate the sound bites and documents that she has collected, but are a distillation of their effect on her as a listener. Now, in his book Caught by History, Ernst von Alphen considers what he calls the Holocaust effect in contemporary art, art which does not represent the events of the Shoah, but rather the impossibility of representation through strategies of reenactment and repetition that are accessed as trauma. He cites Jeffrey Hartman, who deals with the problem of how to focus public memory on traumatic experiences like war or massive violations of human rights. The contemporary viewer is overwhelmed and suffers from, I quote him, an information sickness caused by the speed and quantity of what impinges on us, end of quote. On the other hand, he is concerned with the desensitization or psychic numbing that results from the barrage of explicit violence. On the other hand, the realism and pervasiveness of modern media may also have a performative effect, which is in itself traumatizing. How can we pass on knowledge of the Holocaust or other traumatic events to future generations without also transmitting what Harman calls secondary trauma? And he suggests that the promise for this lies in testimony, which I am suggesting is what these works open up, is a kind of interrelationship, that inscribes the elicited words on the minds of the audience. So I'm going to I just have a few comments here to make. As I think Mea Culpa shows us, such a healing is not forthcoming from media, but demands an embodied relation to the other that is suggested here through both the indexical residue of the artist's body, which incorporates the elicited words, and through our very movement in relation to the unfolding of traumatic narrative. In this way, she has reversed the exchange of primary sensuality for technological sensuality that arises from our immersion in mass media. In that movement, we, of course, also experience the disappearance from view of that narrative's legibility, much like Dreyblatt's Torah scroll. But there is also a gendered point of identification in Kelly's use of the third person she in each of the four panels, and this is the final point that I wanted to make. She has chosen incidents involving women and children whereby we access trauma through the position of the mother. Since postpartum document, Kelly has been concerned with the inscription of women's loss in the symbolic, specifically in the document, the loss of the mother. There were precious few precedents for such a task, though Kristeva has pointed to the semiotic possibilities for women made available through Mariolatry. But Mariolatry, the worship of the Virgin Mary. But the overdetermined image of mother and child that Catholicism offers was precisely what Kelly rejected in postpartum document. So it may seem perverse, given her well-known iconoclastic position, for me to suggest that Kelly's visual imagination has been inflected by the visual culture of Catholicism. The economy of the fetish that she mobilizes in the document has, after all, a long history in the exquisite reliquaries of the Church, and Kelly herself is very familiar with Catholicism's staging of ritual and spectacle, not only through childhood exposure, but through her graduate studies in painting in Florence. As the Surrealists have shown us, even with a knowledge of psychoanalysis, Catholic visuality is hard to shake. Let me be clear, I am not attributing a theological significance to Mea Culpa. It is not the word made flesh, but it does seem to me that in its orientation of the moving body, its modes of identification with the other of suffering, and its anamorphic reminder of our own mortality, that it is informed by the ways in which the Catholic Church narrativizes space, specifically here to the procession of the Stations of the Cross, a story of torture and death frequently depicted in rectangular relief sculpture, which penitents pass on their way to communion, and which imaginatively follows in the sufferer's footsteps. But most important here, in the scenes of degradation and spiritual anguish that lead to and attend the crucifixion, pathos is evoked through our identification with the mother as witness. And so we move in Mea Culpa, as with the recollection mechanism, we move through the space and through that movement, open up the possibility of a different history that might unlock the paralysis of Benjamin's angel. Thank you.
Thank you, Christine.